Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
When I laid my eyes on him for the first time, I immediately knew that he was the one for me. He's amazing.
She's not talking about her husband. She's talking about her pug. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. Our relationship with animals is, as we say on Facebook, complicated. That's an understatement. Humans love animals. We drop big bucks on those we keep as pets. We eat animals. We make them work for us. We protect them and hunt them. We step on some of them without thinking twice while considering granting basic human rights to others. So on today's show, we're going to explore the many layers and facets of this relationship. Let's start with love. Not just any love, but fierce love. His name is Spartacus. It's undoubtedly an ironic choice because he's a skinny little thing with short white fur and a ton of energy. He's part Chihuahua, part Terrier, but he's not a barker. Spartacus is a bit of a celebrity in his South Philadelphia neighborhood. So when he goes out for a walk, he's gonna look sharp.
All right, mister, we're gonna put your sweater on. This is the newest thing. I bought it 2 days ago.
Gita Kurtz has picked a light blue sweater out of an entire drawer filled with dog clothes. This one has an argyle pattern. Think Ivy League ski club outing. Next, she fixes the hair on his head.
And not to forget the mohawk that's made you famous.
Yep, Spartacus has a tiny mohawk.
He's had, an orange dye, a green dye, a blue dye, and then we decided to go with purple this year.
And does he like that?
He does, because everybody says, oh, he's so cute, so he just poses and gets all excited.
Gita Kurtz and Spartacus make for a fetching couple. She's wearing a miniskirt, polka dot tights, and boots. Her black hair is braided in pigtails. Neighbors wave and make small talk as we walk to an upscale pet store called Doggy Style. This is where Kurtz works, but today she's just there to buy Spartacus a new sweater.
Don't yell at me for it.
She's talking to one of the clerks. He has made a deal with her husband, Kyle, to alert him when she's buying more stuff.
The other one. No, Kyle doesn't know.
Kurt says she knows Spartacus is spoiled and that she's spending way too much money on him. He has 4 beds, he eats top-of-the-line expensive raw food with duck and venison, but she feels it's only right because they have a special bond, one that started the second she saw him at a shelter.
And as I walked in, there was this ugly-looking thing, not even a pound. And I'm like, that's my son. So, we're very happy.
Your son, I ask? I mean, he's a dog, right?
We know he's a dog, but he's the best dog. He's our kid.
Kurtz analyzes the dog's reactions to every purchase, how he likes or dislikes a certain sweater or a new bed. When she forgets to thaw out his special raw food, she knows Spartacus is disappointed.
He gives me this look.
What's the look?
He's like, really, Mom? Really?
He calls you Mom.
Yeah, I could see it. You know, he just blinks at me. I'm like, okay, he's giving me the really Mom look.
I should probably admit here that this notion is completely foreign to me. I don't have pets. I like animals just fine, but I don't see them as being like me. So this is all very intriguing to me. I go on to meet Jennifer Augustine and her 2 pugs.
Max is 14 and Frankie is 11. I'd hate to say this, but Max is pretty much my soulmate dog.
She says with Max, it was love at first sight.
He's amazing. He's cocky, which I love. He's independent like me, which I love. It's a connection. He is like the dog version of me.
She loves Max so much she has his pug face tattooed on her forearm. And sometimes she's worried that Frankie, the other pug, feels slighted.
Frankie and my husband are more connected. They have more of the bond that Max and I have. Because Chris, my husband, and Frankie are very similar people.
Do you think of them as people?
Oh, goodness. I believe I do. I do. It's funny because, if someone says, do you have any children? And I'll say my pugs, Max and Frankie.
It's very easy for us to perceive minds in others. So when things look like us and when things make noise, when we interact with them, when they squeal or purr or bark, right? All those cues, I mean, animals don't have language, but they have something close, and those cues compel us to see minds in creatures.
This is Kurt Gray. He is a psychology and neuroscience professor at UNC Chapel Hill, and he studies why people anthropomorphize, meaning perceive a human-like mind in a non-human agent. And he says, yes, of course, pets have minds, and they experience basic emotions like joy or fear, but not the kinds of complicated feelings we often give them credit for.
Those of us who have pets as children, I think we vastly overestimate the amount of mind they have. So people think that their dog has this like rich emotional life and can feel embarrassment and Schadenfreude and nostalgia. And I'm not sure their neural architecture supports that.
Gray has two cats. One is named Chaz, and Chaz has an evil streak at times. I know this because he told me that he and his wife spent a lot of time discussing their cats' personalities.
And do you ever check yourself, given your line of work, do you ever, you know, when you go down that path of what is the cat thinking right now, do you ever just think, okay, stop, the cat is not thinking about that?
Yeah, I think my wife is also a neuroscientist, and we have conversations where we stop ourselves and say, let's really consider the neural architecture of our cats. I think we're giving them too much credit. But then at the end of the day, right, we sing them songs and we snuggle them, so maybe actions speak louder than words.
What do you sing to your cats?
Well, I think maybe my wife doesn't want me letting this out, but we often dance at them during the intro music to TV shows. So the show The Americans has this amazing kind of Russian Cossack music, and so we do like Cossack dances towards Chaz as he's sitting on the couch. He's pretty stoic, so it's all right, but I feel like a fool when I do it, but it's still fun.
So the cats don't truly appreciate your efforts.
Well, they don't not appreciate it. And I think the beautiful thing about perceiving minds is there's enough ambiguity that we can just pretend that Chaz likes us dancing at him.
So two neuroscientists doing a Russian dance at their cats while being aware of the irony of the situation, somewhat. So it seems like we just can't help ourselves. When we spend a lot of time with a pet, are we going to perceive a mind just like ours? New brain science points in that direction, says Nicholas Epley. He studies behavioral science at the University of Chicago.
The same neural systems that are involved in thinking about whether somebody else is lying or telling the truth are also the same kinds of neural systems that are involved in thinking about whether your pet has a guilty look or not.
Epley says we often have viewed anthropomorphism as a human weakness.
But to the extent that that process is the same thing that allows me to recognize that my wife of 20 years loves me, it really suggests a very different kind of understanding of this, that this, I think, reflects a signature strength of our brains. The most amazing thing your brain is able to do is to connect to the mind of another agent, to understand other people. And I think this is a natural outcropping of that.
And just like with the rest of our emotions, love or dislike for fellow humans, anthropomorphism is selective. Which creatures we anthropomorphize depends on different factors. Here's Kurt Gray again.
Cuteness factors into a lot of our decisions about animal morality. So crows, for instance, are very smart. They can understand physics problems that some children can't figure out.
But crows are not that cute. They are not cuddly, and they destroy our crops. So we don't buy them sweaters. We make scarecrows. Where and how we grow up also plays a role, says Gray.
If you work on a farm and you see animals as there to do labor, so cats are there to eat mice and dogs are there to protect your property, then you have a very different perception of animal morality than if you just live in Manhattan and you have a little frou-frou dog and she's your constant companion and you put her in a bag and you take her to Louis Vuitton, etc. So I think it's in some sense giving animals mind is a privilege that we have in our society when, you know, we're wealthy and we can just enjoy them instead of making them work.
Americans spent more than $60 billion on their pets in 2015. And the more we love them and perceive them as human-like, the more money we're going to drop on them. If you look at pet food commercials, there's a conscious effort to highlight things like love, loyalty, special relationships, unbreakable bonds.
Rocky had no idea why Don was gone for so long, but he'd wait for her forever, for any reason, and would always be there with the biggest welcome home.
Right now, research on anthropomorphism is growing, and it goes beyond our pets. Anthropomorphizing means attributing a human mind to a non-human agent, and that can be anything, a cat, a dog, or a tree, a bicycle. And with artificial intelligence gaining momentum, there is a lot of interest in the interactions between people and computers. Nicholas Epley recently ventured into new territories for anthropomorphism.
How do you get somebody to turn their life over to a stupid car?
By stupid car, he means a super high-tech self-driving vehicle. Epley just finished up a research project for General Motors. He studied what would get people over their fears with these cars. And it turns out that people are more trusting when they perceive the car to have a mind.
So when we gave an autonomous vehicle, a car, a voice, it talked to you. It responded to your actions. It told you what was coming ahead and what was happening around it, so it seemed better able to sense what was going on. People felt more comfortable driving in the simulator, and they were more likely to trust the vehicle to drive them safely.
Humans long for connection. It's what makes us human. Only when we feel a connection can we develop trust or begin a relationship. And given that the only frame of reference we have is our human mind, it's no wonder that that's what we perceive in animals we spend a lot of time with. And there's something else. So many people I talk to mentioned the unconditional, non-judgmental nature of their pet relationships. Gita Coates told me that she knows Spartacus isn't thinking what she thinks he's thinking, but it's so nice to imagine. So when she buys him a sweater and she thinks that he likes it, there's no negative feedback. It makes her happy to think that he's happy. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show today is about our relationships with animals, with non-human animals. Jennifer Augustine, who we just heard from, spent over $13,000 on her pug's medical bills over the last 6 years, and he's facing ongoing health issues. He's 11 years old. A lot of people struggle when their pets are getting older and their health is declining. What treatments are appropriate? How much money can and should they spend? And when is it time to say goodbye? There's a new movement in veterinary medicine that could help answer some of these questions. It's something that's become much more important in human medicine, too, hospice and palliative care. Todd Bookman reports.
Paul Rosin has seen lots of dogs come and go during his 79 years. Suki, you get the sense, wouldn't make his Hall of Fame.
You know, we have our particular language. She knows treat. She's not, I would say, less than, among the dogs I've had, I would say she's less than average in intelligence.
Ah, but what she lacks in brains, the white terrier with shaggy hair more than makes up for in loyalty.
Yeah, so she's been a good companion, and she's a surprisingly young dog. I mean, if you look at her, you wouldn't think she was 15 years old. She's pretty active.
Suki is starting to show her 15 years in other ways, though. Her back legs are arthritic, there's a heart murmur, and she started leaving unwanted puddles around the house. That's in part prompted a call to the family's vet, Dr. Tam Mangine, who makes house calls.
Well, we'll go ahead and do her checkup.
Okay.
And I always look in their ears just for any signs of inflammation.
Mangine is one of a fast-growing number of vets who specialize in geriatric and end-of-life care. She avoids aggressive treatments, focusing instead on reducing pain or anxiety for dying pets. And when the time comes, she'll perform in-home euthanasia. Suki's not there yet.
So she has a whole sort of list of chronic medical conditions, no terminal diagnoses, and that's what we consider palliative care as opposed to hospice care. So in her case, we are managing the chronic conditions as they come up, making sure her quality of life is good, trying to keep her from driving her owners insane with urinating in the house and that sort of thing. But, you know, we're not managing any terminal condition for her.
This holistic approach to dying well, to making sure an animal is comfortable and that its owners feel part of the process, takes its cues from the philosophy at the heart of human hospice. Though, of course, there's one big difference.
Veterinarians and pet owners both are a little quick to go to the needle.
Jessica Pierce is with the International Association for Animal Hospice and Palliative Care, a group of veterinarians who are working to bridge the gap between expensive treatment options that a family may not be able to afford and a premature end.
Hospice tries to fill in the realm of possibilities between those two extremes.
But along with extending the animal's life in a pain-free way, pet hospice is also about the owners. It gives them the chance to have the last days or moments take place at home rather than in a clinic. Dr. Danny McVitie is co-founder of Lap of Love, a national franchise of hospice providers.
There is a huge potential to have that pet be as comfortable as possible for as long as possible, and then for the family to grieve in a way that allows them the privacy of displaying their grief and having their grief without having to hide that from anybody.
Lap of Love launched in 2009 and now operates a network of 80 doctors around the country who did more than 15,000 home visits last year. Their clients do pay a premium. In-home euthanasia runs about $250. That's more than most clinics charge. Suki's visit with her vet, Tam Mangine, is just a $70 checkup. They're going to monitor her heart murmur and bladder problems for now, and get her started on a joint supplement.
Those extra 6 months can mean a lot to people. It can allow them time to adjust to the loss. And for the pets, if we can keep them comfortable, even if their day-to-day routine is different, maybe they're sniffing the smells on the porch and watching the birds instead of chasing them through the woods, they're still happy. So why not let them have that joy?
Paul Rosin is on board with that attitude.
I give her more treats than I used to. She likes the dried chicken, which you can get very cheap at Costco. You know, I used to say, I'll give her one or two a day. You know, I'm a spoiler, but now I give her a lot because what the hell? That's one of the things she really loves.
Well, you only live once, right? For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find our podcast on iTunes. We're talking today about our relationship with animals. How far would you go to save a stray cat? Actually, not even to save the cat, but to save the cat's eyesight. Reporter Peter Kermans brings us the extraordinary journey of Marley.
In the summer of 2015, two tiny white kittens were pulled off the streets in the Overbrook neighborhood of Philadelphia by the city's animal control team. They were Marley and Ramona, brother and sister. After 3 days in a city shelter, they were turned over to PAWS, the Philadelphia Animal Welfare Society.
So they actually came to us on July 4th. They were Independence Day kittens for us.
This is Melissa Levy. She's the founding director of PAWS.
And had a number of infections that are very common that we see all the time in kittens and cats that have lived on the street. They had upper respiratory infections and, you know, they were in pretty bad shape.
Pretty bad, but simple infections are really not that difficult to fix. These cats had bigger problems with their eyes. One of Ramona's eyes was so infected it was bulging out of her skull, and Marley had been born without eyelids. He had no eyelids. He could not close his eyes, not to blink, not to sleep, not to protect his eyes from dust.
The condition that Marley had is actually very unusual for us. What Marley had was a genetic deformity that required essentially plastic surgery.
Levy has a Rolodex of a few dozen fosters that will take on cats until permanent owners can be found. But she reserves her special cases like these for one guy in particular, Al Guri.
I'm a professor at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts in Philadelphia.
For almost 40 years now, Guri has lived and worked in an artist loft in Old City. He has outfitted it for both his painting career and his life with cats. He has 5 cats of his own, and next to his easel is a homemade playpen built from plywood scraps in which he keeps sick kittens that he's fostering. And there have been a lot. Over the last 10 years, Guri has fostered over 800 cats in this loft. 800. He keeps them for a few weeks, maybe a few months, until they can be adopted out. He took on Marley and his sister last July.
They were very little. They were only 4 weeks old, so they needed a lot of nurturing at that point, as well as medical care. I had to give them a lot of cuddling, a lot of holding, make sure that they were getting socialized with a human being, but then also the medical care, which, of course, they hated. You know, they don't like drops. Who likes eye drops?
Guri found out pretty quickly that Ramona's infection in her right eye was too far gone. The whole eye would have to be removed. Marley has a genetic deformation called eyelid agenesis. That's when the eyelid did not fully form in utero.
I've seen him sleep, and he just squinches his eyes. The problem is that his eyelashes and the surrounding hair is lying flat on the cornea.
That means the fur around Marley's eye is constantly scratching his eyeball, slowly destroying its surface.
Also, there's an issue of lubrication and constant abrasion. He would develop abscesses.
The easiest way to cure Marley's eye condition, and quite frankly the cheapest, would be just to remove both his eyes altogether.
You know, if there was no other recourse, sure, like Ramona had to have an eye removed. But these were two perfect eyes, and I think being an artist and an art teacher, it had special meaning for me, you know, how important they are.
Guri wanted the best for Marley, but animal rescue has its limitations. Every year, PAWS rescues, nurtures, and adopts out over 3,000 dogs and cats in the Philadelphia area. Most of them are cats.
Unfortunately, our resources prevented us from being in a position to be able to write a blank check.
This is Melissa Levy again.
Once we assessed what our, you know, financial risk constraints were, that was when Al took it into his own hands.
Guri got in touch with a specialty hospital called VSEC, or Veterinary Specialty and Emergency Center. They formed a plan to give plastic surgery to this stray cat. Enter Dr. Shelby Reinstein. She's a veterinary ophthalmologist.
This particular surgery is not rare. The condition itself is super common, especially here in Philadelphia, where we have a lot of strays and a lot of street cats. You know, things don't form right when there's a lot of inbreeding.
So 7 months after being pulled off the street, Marley went under the knife.
So we're going to cut here, right, and we're going to come down all the way to about here.
What Reinstein is doing is grafting a piece of Marley's inner lip onto his eyebrow so the lip tissue will become his eyelid tissue.
It's a mucous membrane. Gingiva, which is the inner lining, you know, when you bite your cheek, that's very similar to conjunctiva, which is the lining of the eyelids. So the tissues themselves are quite similar. One makes tears, one makes spit.
Eyelid agenesis surgery is expensive, particularly for a cat that doesn't have an owner. The hospital gave Marley a deal with a price cut, and Guri tapped all his friends for a few hundred dollars. But that still leaves a $3,000 medical bill, which Guri will pay out of his own pocket. After surgery, Guri took Marley home, where his sister Ramona was waiting for him. After about a month of recovery, Guri will give the two cats back to Paws so they can be adopted.
You know, I love them. He's a sweet little guy. He prances around the house like a pony. His sister likes to sit on my shoulder and groom my hair, so that will be missed.
Guri cared for Marley and Ramona for 9 months. That's an extraordinary amount of time for a foster, plus $3,000, and he's probably never going to see them again. Melissa Levy hopes they will be taken together.
The level of generosity and the level of charity toward this particular kitten was so far beyond what we would have been able to do on our own. It's just, it's an incredibly moving thing to watch unfold.
For The Pulse, I'm Peter Crimmins.
You're
listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Humans have this really strong desire to help animals. Dropping huge bucks to save stray kittens, like we just heard in Peter's story, volunteering at shelters, or sometimes attempting to assist species living in their natural ecosystems. But sometimes our help makes things worse. That's what happened with some gardeners who wanted to create the perfect setting for monarch butterflies. Right now, these beautiful creatures are making their way through Texas. They are on their way to get as far as South America for the winter. Mose Bouchel has this report.
I want to be clear. No one is saying you should not try to help the monarchs. You just need to make sure you're giving them the right kind of help. The Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center is a sprawling botanical garden in the Texas Hill Country outside of Austin. I went there to learn more and hopefully see some monarchs for myself.
They're not here yet, but there are plenty of other butterflies that look a lot like monarchs.
Yeah, actually, a lot of people assume that these are monarchs because they're orange and black, and they have, you know, some black stripes on them.
I'm hoping that I can pick one single monarch out just to say I saw one, but maybe not yet.
My host was Andrea DeLongamaya. She's the director of horticulture at the Wildflower Center. She says for years people have been planting milkweed to encourage monarchs to feed and reproduce.
The problem is that the most commonly available milkweeds are not native here, the tropical milkweed or scarlet milkweed.
And recent research shows that non-native milkweeds can hurt the butterflies. The problem is that non-native plants can survive later into the winter, so the monarchs stop at the plants and don't keep migrating further south. If they don't migrate, they become more susceptible to parasites or even die in the winter cold.
So that was a hard lesson to learn.
Dara Satterfield researches monarchs at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. She says the trick is to plant native milkweed that will die in the frost. Also, this time of year, she says planting flowers is even more helpful than milkweed. The sugary nectar helps the butterflies store up fat for their winter hibernation in Mexico.
I think of them as like these tiny camels in a way. They store up resources to survive harsh conditions in their bodies for several months.
Back at the Wildflower Center, a bee buzzed on a native flower. Andrea DeLongamaya said there's one other thing to consider, insecticides, especially systemic ones that get into the tissue and pollen of the plant. There's one kind called a neonicotinoid. If your milkweed has that, you could be killing the very monarchs you're trying to help.
When the caterpillars eat them, they get poisoned, but also it can be transmitted into the nectar. So even pollinating species that are just taking nectar out of the plants could be affected by it.
So, she says, if you buy flowers or milkweed to plant for monarchs, confirm with the seller that the plants are native and they don't have these poisons in them. Then, just as I was about to leave, she spotted a monarch.
High five.
Hey.
Mission accomplished.
For The Pulse, I'm Mose Bouchel.
Mose is a reporter at public radio station KUT in Austin, Texas. All right, from beautiful butterflies floating through the air, we're going to get on to something a little bit more raunchy. Cover your ears, kids. We're going to talk about animal sex, because without animal sex, there would be no animals. It seems like it would be in nature's best interest to make it easy for animals to procreate, but instead, it's often incredibly complicated. Joining us now is Karen Bondar. She is a biologist, a TV host, and an author, and she has a new book that's called Wild Sex, The Science Behind Mating in the Animal Kingdom. Karen, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I was thinking about some of my own basic assumptions about animal sex before I started to look into your book. I guess I've always been thinking that animals have sex only to procreate. True or false?
It's false. However, there isn't a lot of pleasure, as we humans like to think. So I think the most misleading thing is that sex is fun and pleasurable. It is sometimes, but very rarely.
And my other assumption was that animals have sex like once a year, seasonally at least.
So some animals do. It really varies by species. You have some animals that have one annual breeding season. You have other animals like dolphins that are having sex several times an hour, 24 hours a day.
What? Why?
They're what's known as hypersexual, and they use sex for various modes of communication in addition to reproduction. So I guess to your first question, reproduction is definitely one of them, but there's a lot of other reasons that animals do have sex outside of just purely for procreation.
So what are some of the other reasons for sex?
A lot of times there will be sex for some kind of social bonding. This is especially where we see a lot of homosexual sex. It's to kind of ease tension between males in a pod or in a tribe. You can also see sex as a means of establishing a dominance hierarchy. So you can't have sex, but I can. And therefore, here you can watch me doing it, but you're not allowed to. And it sort of reestablishes who's in charge of whom.
How are the mates picked? And who chooses, generally speaking? We always think kind of the male is the one to choose.
Isn't that interesting? Well, in fact, in the animal kingdom, it's the opposite way around. And this has to do with the fact that sperm is abundant and cheap. In a male human, for example, there are about 70 million sperm per ejaculation, whereas a female, we ovulate once per month. And if we happen to get fertilized, we are out of reproductive commission for a further 9 months. This makes who we have sex with a very big decision for a female. And this is true for females all over the animal kingdom. Eggs are expensive, so females are choosy. And this is why we see males that are often very adorned. Think peacock, whether it's feathers or antlers or some kind of a dance move or a song. Males are often the ones trying to win the affections of females.
Do we know, are there animals that are monogamous, that stay together and maybe mate several times?
So there are animals, mostly birds, that are socially monogamous. So they will select the same breeding partner season upon season. And they will mate with that partner and, be together to raise the offspring in the nest. Now, sexually monogamous is different from socially monogamous. Even in bird species that we previously concluded were sexually monogamous, when we were able to develop techniques of genetic sequencing, what we found out is that, nope, those offspring do not belong to that dad. So dad goes off, does some visiting to other females, and then comes back home. And while dad is off doing that, mom might entertain a visitor of her own.
So it's not very Disney-esque.
I know, right? And in mammals, it is non-existent. I mean, in any species where fertilization of females is internal, such as in our own species, a male can't be sure that he is the father of the offspring. So why on earth would he stick around? It doesn't make biological sense.
I guess not. Do animals transmit diseases when having sex?
Yes. STIs are extremely common in the animal kingdom. And take koalas in Australia. These guys are, of course, super cute and cuddly, and they're the poster child for the country, for the nation down under. And almost all of them, like 99% of the indigenous population of koalas, has chlamydia. And it's been transmitted sexually throughout the entire populations, and it's having huge, like, negative effects on these guys. It can actually, in the end, cause you to be infertile. Because this is such a big problem in Australia, a lot of research has gone into finding and developing a vaccine for these guys, which has recently been done.
If we think about our own mating behaviors as humans, let's say a lot of people are now looking for mates online. And when you describe yourself online, you tend to make yourself, whatever, a little bit taller, a little bit thinner, a little bit younger, a little bit smarter. Do animals do that?
Deception is alive and well in the animal kingdom. Everything from males pretending to be females in order to gain advantage from other males before they mate, try to steal the mates of the males that they're attracting. Other males will use deception in terms of sending out warning calls. Hey, ladies, there's a predator. You better stick by me. So many ways in which males and females, for that matter, can be deceptive in terms of being able to win a partner. It's a tough world out there.
We sometimes hear about this male-eating female that has sex with the male and then kills the male, or the male just perishes. What is the evolutionary thinking behind that?
Right, because on the surface, that seems really counterintuitive. How is a male supposed to increase his genetic blueprints in future generations if he's dead? Interestingly, in a lot of these species that are often spiders or praying mantids, males will only have one or two chances at copulation, period, throughout their lives. And so it often actually makes sense for a male to impregnate a female with his sperm and then keep her busy for a while so she's not out there selecting other mates. So his sperm has a greater chance to reach her eggs. Now, just how can he keep her busy? Well, she's eating his body. That takes a little bit of time. And so there is actually, oh, I know, I kid you not, there is a lot of evidence, and especially in praying mantids, the male's body actually keeps having sex with the female after she's ripped his head off. It's kind of like a chicken running around with its head cut off, except that it's a praying mantid that's continuing to have sex with his female partner, even though he doesn't have a head.
Do you ever just think, this is just too gross?
You know, it is absolutely horrifying sometimes, but I think for me, it's fascinating. And I often like to put a human spin on my stories and just say, guys, we are so lucky. It is remarkably uncomplicated to be human. As much as we like to complain about it, at least you're not getting stabbed in the head or getting killed while you're having sex.
And your mate is eating your head.
Right?
Are there animals that just have a low sex drive? I mean, none of this sounds very fun. So are there animals that just kind of choose to say, yeah, yeah.
I'd rather not. You know, generally speaking, because we biologists ascribe that all animals want to maximize their genetic blueprints in future generations, we don't tend to say there's a lot of animals out there who don't want to have sex. But there is an incredibly interesting example from olive baboons in Nigeria, where females will eat this African black plum when it comes into fruit. And they're generalist eaters, so they can eat pretty much anything they want. But when the fruit of the plum is available, the females will go for it. The males don't, but the females do. Now, the plums contain such a high level of progesterone that it essentially shuts the female's reproductive systems down. I think that's maybe a good example where females are sending a pretty clear message to biologists as well as to their male counterparts. You know what? We want a break.
Karen, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Karen Bonder is the author of Wild Sex, The Science Behind Mating in the Animal Kingdom.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Our show today is about the many complicated interactions between humans and animals. Our next story is about one of the side effects of humans eating animals. Most commercial fishing is not an exact operation. Big nets catch a lot of species unintentionally. This is typically referred to as bycatch. It affects dolphins, birds, juvenile fish, and sea turtles, many of which are already endangered. When sea turtles get stuck in a net, they drown. A team of scientists is now trying to prevent this problem with sound. Paige Flager reports.
Imagine a sea turtle. It's swimming around in the ocean, going about its everyday business, and then all of a sudden, it hears a sound. Something like this. The sea turtle's ears, yes, they have ears, perk up. That noise is not something it usually hears in the ocean. Now it's on high alert, looking out for something abnormal in the water, like a fisherman's net. That's the idea behind Wendy Dow-Piniak's work at Gettysburg College. She's an assistant professor in the Environmental Studies Department, and she specializes in sea turtles and sound.
The goal of our team's research is to develop bycatch reduction technologies or tools that can reduce sea turtle bycatch but also maintain target fish catch and market values that can also be implemented in a variety of different types of fisheries.
In non-science speak, the idea is for fishermen to catch what they want to catch without catching sea turtles accidentally.
In essence, what we want to do is to design some kind of alerting signal that tells the sea turtle that something's out of the ordinary. So, pay attention. But we also want it to be a cue that the target catch or fish that the fishers are trying to catch aren't alerted by.
But that's kind of hard, right? Like, basically, they need something that only sea turtles can hear, not other fish. Kind of like how a dog can hear super high-pitched sounds, but humans can't.
But people hadn't really considered acoustic deterrent devices for sea turtles because most sea turtles and fish hear very similar frequencies.
The fishery that she and her team are working in is in Baja, Mexico. And the fish that that fishery is trying to get is halibut. Now, halibut is a flat fish because it hangs out on the bottom of the ocean. It doesn't have a swim bladder, which is an air-filled sac that keeps most fish buoyant. And, luckily for Piniac, they have really bad hearing.
So flatfish hear generally below 200 hertz, which are very, very low frequencies.
It sounds like this.
And sea turtles can hear up to about 1600 hertz.
Which sounds like this. So as long as they attach a sound to the net with a frequency between that low sound and that high sound, theoretically, only the turtles could hear it and be warned, and the halibut would swim into the net just like normal. They went with frequencies around 300 hertz.
We wanted to pick a signal that we knew the sea turtles would be able to detect quite easily.
Piniac and her team made a device using a recorder that played the sound, an amplifier that made it louder, and then a speaker further down on the net to play the noise out into the ocean. It's called an acoustic deterrent device. Of course, there's already sound in the ocean. Researchers call this an acoustic habitat, or soundscape. It's a really important sensory cue for marine animals.
Animals in the ocean often use acoustic cues to communicate with each other, to find food, and to navigate, or for just general environmental awareness.
At their study site in Baja, the ocean usually sounds like this.
The crackle and popping that you hear in the background are small crustaceans called snapping shrimp. They make that sound by snapping shut their claws and use it to stun their prey. You can actually hear the sounds of waves crashing on the shore and the boat rocking and also a little bit of wind noise.
So that's where the experiment comes in. They put two nets into the water. The first doesn't make any sound. The second, the one with the acoustic deterrent devices, sounds like this. The nets are close enough together that they're in the same environment and could catch the same things, but they're far enough apart that any marine life near the control net wouldn't be able to hear any of the sounds from the deterrent devices on the other net.
Over the last two summers, we found that adding the acoustic devices to nets reduces the number of sea turtles you catch by 65%, which is huge.
It's huge, Piniac says, but there's still a lot of work to be done. The team wants to test the devices in other fisheries that target flatfish, like flounder and turbot. They want to study not just the decreased catch of turtles, but also how the devices might affect the fish that fishermen actually want to catch. The end goal, she says, is to create a product that fishermen really want to use. For The Pulse, I'm Paige Flager.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We've been talking about our relationships with animals today. My childhood pet was a bird, a yellow parakeet named Goldie. Having a bird didn't exactly score big with my friends, and I'm pretty sure my mom picked this pet because of the minimal cleanup involved. But for centuries, birds had a very special place in our homes. Before stereos, before radios, nightingales and canaries were trained to sing to entertain us. I guess you could say they were the medieval public radio. But when music producer and researcher Ian Nagoski went digging through old records a few years back, he discovered an interesting turn in this entertainment relationship, man imitating birds.
Pretty much all of my research begins with just the process of going through old 78 RPM discs and seeing what's lying around that nobody has bothered with. I noticed that there were lots of recordings of birds themselves, accompanied by musical instruments. It was a pretty big thing. There were hundreds of such recordings made. This is one of those many recordings of some kind of canary aviary accompanied by some sentimental piano music. I can't remember the performer's name, and frankly, who cares? I think it's sentimental schlock. People wanted something pretty to listen to around the house, and in the early days of the record industry, from the last decade of the 19th century through the first two decades of the 20th century, the record companies were really casting around in the dark for anything they thought people might want to listen to at home. At a certain point, I noticed that there were recordings of people imitating animals. In particular, there was a genre of people whistling in imitation of birds.
A good example is that of the catbird.
And so I put the needle on and go, what in the world is this? It would have been recorded in the mid-teens, I guess, about 100 years ago. At first, I would say I was just, delighted by what an interesting, odd skill it was, how exotic it was to our present time. I'd never seen anybody do such a thing.
Here is Alec Walker, the Birdman, to teach you how.
No, listen, it's hard. I think it's undeniable that a real virtuoso can't pretty well fool you that they're not being a bird. You know, they sound like birds to me. They sound better than birds, actually, which is odd.
Blue Jay.
These bird imitators were live performers. They were stage people who were traveling around playing in church halls, and by and large, vaudeville. They were people who were amazing and amusing their audiences. The best of them, by far, is Charles Kellogg. He was a great performer, and he got very, very rich. Kellogg claimed that he had a bird syrinx, an entirely different vocal apparatus than other human beings, which was not true, to say the least. There's a less polite way to put that, but that was showbiz.
American Robin.
So I've given it some thought, and I think the reason that bird imitation doesn't exist so much anymore as an entertainment thing is because in order for it to be really amazing and wonderful, it's got to be in person. To have it through some media is actually less wonderful and less amazing than to see a human being with the sound of a bird coming out of
them. Little California quail.
People have been looking to birds and wondering what it is they're trying to say for hundreds, thousands of years. You know, reveling in the wonder of birdsong and how musical, how obviously beautiful it is, and how incredibly foreign it is to us, too. In the opera cycle by Richard Wagner, The Ring of the Nibelungen, the character Siegfried slays a dragon and eats its heart, and he gets magical powers. And what magical power is it? It's to understand the language of birds.
And then by opening and closing them, you get the varying volume of sound.
How wonderful that would be. What a perfect magic power to have. How amazing would that be, to know what it is that they're saying and singing.
Like this. Now you have the four sounds that make up the laugh of the kookaburra. And when you can make them satisfactorily, join them all together. Now you should be able to imitate Jackie quite easily.
That was music collector and researcher Ian Nagoski. Alana Gordon produced this story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, and we had engineering help this week from Adam Staniszewski. Paige Flager is our associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next week on The Pulse, we're going to take you to an operating room where medicine and plumbing meet.
So it's similar to actually stopping up a pipe.
He's having a procedure done to remove a clot out of his leg that has grown from his hip down to his ankle, like Roto-Rooter it out.
We'll meet a surgeon who is hoping to increase the flow of knowledge about a silent killer, one plumbing job at a time. Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.